Welcome to News and Brews. I'm Errol Yabke.
And I'm Mike Heslin.
And Mike, it's our last News and Brews of the year. And what a year it's been.
Today, after a lightning round, first round, focusing on all of our faves, Kyrsten Sinema, Elon Musk, the Taliban, gun violence, etc.
Pete Best of the Beatles.
Of course. We'll recap what each of us sees as the biggest story of 2022.
I'll talk about why I think Russia's invasion of Ukraine was the biggest international story.
And I'll get into the state of American democracy, starting with a trip down memory lane dotted with fatalism.
In true News and Brews fashion. Can't wait.
All right, let's get into it. Hey, Errol.
Hey, Mike.
Happy holiday season to you.
Happy holiday season. Day four of Hanukkah, I believe.
Yes. Well, we're coming up on the fourth night.
Fourth night.
So as we record, it's the third day because it goes sundown to sundown.
Yeah. We were on Tuesday this week. We decided to pick up our kids a little early and go down to just the ellipse, just on the other side of the White House. And we were actually there right at sundown. So we saw it go from two lights on the national menorah to three.
Oh, cool.
There was also a Christmas tree there, et cetera, et cetera. But
yeah, you know, on the side, we can have a tree on the side.
Yeah. Joe Biden's house had a good Christmas tree. My kids, it's one word.
Joe Biden. Is that J apostrophe Biden?
Maybe it's Joe Biden.
Yeah.
Maybe it's like J-O apostrophe Biden, which he would probably be okay with. He's like,
yeah, like it's short for Jor Biden.
Y'all have plans for the holidays?
We are local for Christmas. Have a whole host of traditions local with Bree's family and some with mine as well. But then between Christmas and New Year's and through New Year's, we'll be down in Florida with some friends, which would be really nice.
Nice. Yeah, we're going to go to Puerto Rico.
Oh, awesome.
For 5 days with the Abels. So
very cool. San Juan.
San Juan and who knows where else. I think our Airbnb is not in San Juan, but it's not that, it's an island.
Yeah, yeah. I love Puerto Rico. I've only been once, but like old San Juan is so fucking cool.
Yeah, we're excited. We decided to go down there right around the time that they got hit by a big hurricane. And we were like, oh, should we consider elsewhere? And a couple of Lauren's colleagues who work down there were like, no, you should go down. Like they will have recovered enough by then. And actually like, it's probably good that you're going down.
Amazing.
Yeah. Should we talk about the news?
Well, let's first talk about what we're drinking.
Oh, there's that. I like the brews part of what we do, but I also really like the news part.
Yeah. I mean, our hearts are in the right place.
Yeah. Fair enough. What are you drinking?
I've got returning friend of the show, Wandering Bear cold brew from my refrigerator. Closest thing I have to a coworker in my home office is Wandering Bear cold brew. Hugely reliable, always gives a boost to the office morale. So yeah, maybe up for promotion next year. Who knows?
I like how you're having an afternoon coffee too.
It was either this or tequila.
Is tequila brewed? Is that allowed?
I'm actually thinking I might make January liquor month on News and Brews just to kind of counteract all the responsible people who are doing dry January.
That's fair. I'm in. I have a Great Lakes Brewing Company Christmas ale because it seemed appropriate. It. This is a delicious beer. It's 7.5 alcohol by volume. And it's like one of those when you drink beer in the winter, it's still cold, it's in your fridge, but like you want a beer that warms you up. Listeners can't see me right now, but it's cold as shit in my basement. And so I have a blanket wrapped around me. I just needed something to warm the insides. And there's nothing like a good Christmas ale to do that.
So that is a fantastic beer. It's a hit every year. I used to, like 10, 15 years ago, I ran a coffee shop that also sold beer and wine. And Great Lakes was one of our suppliers. And we would get the Christmas ale and it was like a stampede every year.
Yeah.
Here's what I don't understand though. Great Lakes, I think in my opinion is probably the best Christmas ale, but every Christmas ale is like pretty solid. You don't really go wrong if you grab a Christmas ale off the shelf. However, every winter ale tastes like absolute pee-pee.
Yeah.
How is it?
I don't know. Christmas, there's something about the Christmas aspect. I don't know. I got this from Calvert Woodley, which is quite frankly a gem
in the
District of Columbia.
It's a favorite for sure.
Yeah. Christmas ale, happy Christmas, Merry Hanukkah, etc.
etc. Let's talk about the news. We've got a bit of a lightning first round today. We want to get to our main stories. To kick things off, the Taliban announced this week that girls and women will no longer be allowed to attend high schools and universities in Afghanistan.
Charming.
This wasn't obviously the biggest shock of the century, but observers in the U.S. were surprised when, in reaction, Josh Hawley raised his fist in the air.
Going to have a big effect. That's a useful one, yeah.
Elon Musk banned a bunch of journalists from Twitter, then in the backlash put out a poll asking if he should step down as CEO, saying he would abide by the results. Then when the poll said overwhelmingly that he should in fact step down, according to like 17 million people, he said, sure, he would eventually, but not until he can find a suitable replacement, which he is not actively looking for.
I thought, did he actually lose? I didn't see the final results.
Oh yeah, it wasn't close. It was like 57-43 or something. and that is your regular update on sad divorced men whose only joy comes from being the main character on Twitter with fading hopes it is no longer a weekly segment in 2023.
You're here. Alcohol, yes. Elon Musk, no. So I also saw this week, Mike, that gun violence is now the leading cause of death amongst American, wait for it, children.
Yeah.
Because please, Mike, please tell me more about how gender-neutral bathrooms are hurting our kids.
Well, maybe the answer lies in Hunter Biden's laptop. I'm sure we'll find out. Senator Kyrsten Sinema announced she is leaving the Democratic Party and switching to independent. One anonymous Democrat said, "Now I know how the Beatles felt when they lost Pete Best on drums."
Who?
For color, it's me. I'm the anonymous Democrat, and I think that joke might have only been for me.
Yeah, I think that's true. I don't know what you were doing last weekend, Mike, but I was certainly yelling at a television because Argentina won the World Cup against France.
They did. Incredible game.
In what can only, totally agree, I think it was probably one of the best sporting events in history, quite frankly. And it really cemented Lionel Messi at the top of anybody's GOAT list. I'm happy to fight anybody who, on Twitter mostly, who disagrees with me. Reached for comment while standing on a street corner in Lisbon, trying to give away his autograph to anyone who would take it. Unemployed striker Cristiano Ronaldo said, "Well, at least I'm prettier."
I mean, it's a pretty dude right there.
It's something.
I thought he was employed. Isn't he going to Saudi Arabia?
Oh, is that it? I mean, I think so. I guess it's employed from like a money perspective, but it's still kind of unemployed.
Yeah. He's like the live tour of soccer.
At least he didn't come to the MLS.
No, here's the thing about the World Cup final, which was an incredible game, emotional roller coaster.
Wow, spectacular.
But I think also illustrates why many Americans remain skeptical of soccer. Which is, you know, this has been widely panned as one of, if not the greatest soccer matches in history.
Mm-hmm.
The first 70 minutes were a total snooze fest. So it's like when there's a series on TV and they say like, just like get through like, you know, the first three or four episodes, except it's like, just get through what's supposed to be three quarters of the game and then it'll get good.
Yeah. It looked like Argentina was going to run away with it. And then Mbappe had a shot of Wheaties and all of a sudden they were back.
Yeah, that guy's got two gears. And
no, I think that guy has like 37 gears.
Oh, see, he always looks like for like three quarters of the game, he's going in slow motion and then he just turns it on.
Yep. Very dangerous. All right. Shall we get into our main stories?
Let's do it. So for our main stories today, we are, each of us was given by ourselves the task of picking our biggest story from the year gone by, our very own Spotify Wrapped 2022, but for our news and brews content. So
I hate when we give ourselves homework.
So we followed a lot of different story threads throughout the year. I think that's something I love about doing this show, is that we follow up on things we've talked about in the past, and we can really, for ourselves, figure out what are the narratives directionally, where are things in the world moving. And so to look at a bit of a retrospective on a couple of those biggest stories from the year, how they developed throughout the year, and where they might go from here.
Yeah. And one of those threads was Ukraine. And we had actually started talking about Ukraine, I believe, in late 2021, because there was a Russian military buildup and kind of there was some rumblings, but we and just about everybody else were like, nah, it's not going to happen. Well, turns out we were wrong. Everybody was wrong. But I even debated, it was sort of obvious that I was going to pick Ukraine as this, but I sort of debated whether or not to even focus on that. There were a lot of issues that were not related to a war on European soil. And I was like, am I being selfish? Am I being Eurocentric or sort of like only caring about when like white people are at war? Mm. And I did actually think about this, but I think, you know, we live in the United States of America, and I'm interested in US foreign policy. And I would say for at least five reasons, I think this was actually the most important US foreign policy story this year. You know, the national security strategy, this is not one of the five, but the national security strategy came out recently, and it's a lot about China and geostrategic competition, but they had to rewrite the whole damn thing.
Yeah.
You know, based on, like, if you had asked them in January what was going to be the outline, it would be completely different than what it was later in the year when they released it. And that was, I would argue, in large part because of Russia's February 24th invasion of Ukraine.
And I think they said that pretty explicitly, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
As a side note, there's a great, I don't even remember what show it is, but friend of News and Brews, Richard Fontaine, was on another podcast giving a breakdown of the national security strategy. Just really excellent window into it. I'll find it and link it.
Yeah, we should do that. That was a great episode that he did with us. We should have him back on. So I think there's at least five reasons why the Ukraine story was the most important one from a U.S. foreign policy perspective for me this year. The first one, and I alluded to this, was like, we weren't the only ones that got this wrong. Everybody got it wrong. Everybody was like, no, there's no way that Russia's going to invade. It makes no sense. Well, we got it wrong because it does make no sense. And it did, and it still makes no sense from a practical perspective. If we're taking that sort of practical lens in trying to analyze whether Russia would invade, then it doesn't make any sense. Turns out Putin is not a practical actor, and we live in a world where irrational actors like Putin have nukes. Second point.
Is Putin divorced?
So there's all this, like, not suspicion, but like chatter about his family. Hmm. And it's not quite like Kim Jong-un levels of secrecy, but there's like very little is known about his family. Hmm. And it was actually a rather big deal when one of his daughters was sanctioned a couple months ago, in part because people were like, wait, he has a daughter and that's her. And I'm sure like the intelligence agencies know some of this, but long-winded way of saying, I have no idea, because the guy, it's not like he's living on the cover of Page Six. So.
No, he acts like he's divorced though.
Second point, and this is more of a positive one. I think the U.S. proved it can lead again. In a way, Joe Biden and the U.S. made America great again on the world stage. After a pretty disastrous exit from Afghanistan in 2021, which we've talked about here and other people have as well, the U.S. was not only able to funnel weaponry, our favorite materiel, and money and assistance to Ukraine, it was able to unify European support and breathe new life into NATO, which is not no small task, because, you know, the last administration for 4 years just spent 4 years bashing multilateralism and antagonizing NATO allies and cozying up to autocrats. And so Russia's invasion of Ukraine showed that multilateralism can work and that the US is still a leader in that system.
Yeah, talk about Biden being the perfect person in the job when this happened. I mean, the speed with which the US was able to assemble this coalition and build the will among allies, or at least help build the will among allies. You know, I think there's clearly Europe has its own interest in pushing Russia back from Ukraine. But has been remarkable to see, and at least so far, the staying power that the resolve of particularly those European countries who are really feeling the squeeze of loss of Russian gas supplies are showing has been remarkable. And the fact that Biden was vice president, was chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, has personal relationships with all of these leaders when they kick off a conversation on any of this stuff, I think has borne a ton of fruit here.
Yeah, and from day one, even, you know, before day one during the campaign, he was talking about reinvigorating multilateralism. And this is exactly when you need friends and allies.
That's right. I think one of our first episodes was America's Back, exclamation point or question mark.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exclamation point it is.
Turns out it's exclamation point. Which, you know, you mentioned the hurt that Europe is feeling on gas, and this leads to my third point. The Russian invasion of Ukraine showed just how interconnected, and I would argue vulnerable, globalized supply chains are, especially food and agriculture on one hand and energy on the other hand. So on the former, it's quite honestly terrifying that so much of the world's wheat and other staple crops come from just two countries, and they're at war with each other. And so they basically get to decide whether there's going to be famine in other places. That's really terrifying. On the latter energy point, which you brought up, much of the discussion has been about how, you know, some European countries are sort of reneging on their green energy goals because they're, you know, turning coal plants back on and just trying to find any alternative sources of heating throughout what is probably going to be a pretty cold winter in Europe, because Russia has threatened to turn off the gas, which I think that's legitimate, and we should call that out as, you know, being unfortunate. But I have a slightly different take, which is I think in the longer term, I think this is going to be exactly what Europe needed, this need to gain energy independence from Russia could be the quickest thing to precipitate the almost full clean energy transition in Europe. Because they're, you know, they know that they can't burn coal forever. You know, you're seeing huge investments in like energy technology, clean energy technology that is going to not be online right away, but could within the next 5 years really help Europe transition. You also, as an aside, this is another bit of news maybe we should have included in the start, but their fusion technology has for the first time been proven to put out more energy than it uses to generate that energy. And we're not going to see that necessarily pay dividends in the short term, but I think these are all reasons to be relatively optimistic about kind of green energy transition, especially in places like Europe.
That's really interesting. I love this silver lining too. I think this Christmas ale is having a good effect on you.
It's all this like honey and spices. Mm-hmm. That's just really sitting well. So fourth point, Europe does have the capacity to accept huge numbers of refugees when they want to. And this proved it. Obviously, they don't want to a lot of the time. And I'm not going to get into all the reasons why that may or may not be true. But I think this was a really important demonstration of solidarity and humanitarianism that I think the global community should look back to and say, when the next crisis inevitably comes up, like, can we muster the amount of support that Europe did for Ukraine?
That's really interesting, because I feel like this was covered early on post February 24th, but has really receded from the news headlines. Do you have a sense of how the scale of refugee flows into Europe from Ukraine compares to, say, that from Syria in 2015?
Oh man, way more Ukrainians.
Wow.
Like 10x the number of people that came in 2015 and 16. The difference being they were given official status, they were given legal status, whereas other people sort of came and wanted to claim asylum, and they had to kind of create this new thing for the Syrians and others that were arriving, and they were very slow to do so. They created a new thing for Ukrainians in like 5 days. Wow. After February 24th. Maybe it was a week, but like it was ridiculously fast from a bureaucratic perspective. And I think that showed that they can do this when mm-hmm. they want to. The other difference is like countries have done a really good job of like integrating Ukrainians into the economy, into the education system. And Ukrainians themselves have done a good job of that. They're not clustering in one particular area of Warsaw, right? They're like living in apartments all over the city and trying to figure out, and they're learning languages and their kids are in school. So all that means that I think they may be in outside of Ukraine for longer than people are willing to admit. And I think it's going to be hard for people to go back permanently. But again, that's something to watch moving forward.
Interesting. And do you have a sense of why the response in 2022 was so different than that in 2015 from the European governments?
So lots of people have been quick to be like, oh, it's racist. You know, they do this for like, you know, white Christian people, but they don't for Black people from Sub-Saharan Africa mm-hmm. or, you know, sort of Middle Easterners. And look, I think that's part of it. But I think that we are always more welcoming to our neighbors. And there are such historical ties between Ukraine and Poland, for example, that it's not surprising to me that they would lend a hand. I think the US and the EU and other organizations have been really good at sort of providing support as needed to these governments that were kind of hosting these people. But look, I think that it's almost always the case that like Ugandans are more welcoming to South Sudanese and Congolese refugees than they would otherwise be. Like it would be weird if like millions and millions of Ukrainians showed up in Uganda. So I think that there's a little bit of that going on as well. But I also think like, look, most of the funding for displacement refugee issues around the world comes from like Europe and the US. And it's always seen as like a problem that's over there. Well, when it's a problem here, you start seeing levels of generosity and funding and welcome that go above and beyond what they were willing to give elsewhere.
Yeah, really interesting.
So final point on this, fifth and final point, and here I want to look a little bit ahead. I know we've been looking back at sort of 2022, but building on some of those points that we just talked about, like 2022 saw war again on European soil for the first time in decades, and really interstate war, which is something that we mm-hmm. haven't seen in a really long time. There was sort of ethnic conflict in the 90s with the Balkans, but really this has been, you know, from the sort of proxy Cold War conflicts or even World War II that we've seen this sort of state-on-state level of invasion and war and violence. And unfortunately, I think that that's not going anywhere anytime soon. I think for a couple of reasons, this war is going to be with us and most importantly with the Ukrainians for quite a while. I think that Russia shows little sign of backing down, and you're starting to see more chatter from people like Henry Kissinger about like the need to stop the war and precipitate peace, which I'm all about peace, as you know.
As is Henry Kissinger, famously.
Well, yeah, famously. But they're saying that basically, even if it means deferring adjudication of who controls, you know, Eastern Ukraine for another day. And I'm hard pressed to think that will be an acceptable solution for Kyiv.
Or a stable solution for anyone, right? If you defer adjudication, the threat remains constant and the conditions around the threat could worsen.
100%. And there's already lots of evidence that Russia is sort of forcibly removing people, Ukrainians who are loyal to Kyiv, like mm-hmm. removing them, including lots of children to Russia. I did a a media hit. I was talking about this a couple of weeks ago on the pod with the Georgian service of VOA talking about this. And that's, you know, like those parts of Eastern Ukraine, if left to Russian devices, are going to look very different. And so if you leave it adjudication and that adjudication comes because of some, you know, vote or referendum or something like that, like the people who are, even if it is fair and open, which it won't be, those are going to be different people that are deciding that, right? So I'm hard pressed to think that that's an acceptable or, like you said, a durable solution for Kyiv. And quite frankly, Putin doesn't appear eager to hand anything back. So I think this is going to be sort of an icy slog for the next few months. And then there will be renewed fighting when it thaws. Ukraine had good momentum going into the winter. We'll see if they can maintain that, but you never know. I think because of that slog that is to come, there's a couple ways of thinking about this and a couple reasons why I'm a little bit worried. One is that Europe has stepped up in terms of receiving Ukrainian refugees, and there is lots of sort of funding and support going, but it's not as much as the US. And despite the fact that European governments have increased their defense spending, they're going to need to provide much, much more assistance. At exactly the same time that Ukraine fatigue is setting in all across the continent.
Like, yep.
Fuel prices are up. People know that's because of Russia. They know it's because of Ukraine. Food prices are up, et cetera. And that's important because I don't think U.S. funding is limitless, at least not at the current high levels. That I don't know if you saw this, Mike, but the government funding bill that just came out, there's all these photos on Twitter of like people holding thousands of sheets of paper and like big stacks. Like, it's a massive funding bill. It included $45 billion in new emergency funding for Ukraine, which is $8 billion more than the Biden administration had asked for. So that's humanitarian, that's weapons, that's guns, that's, you know, economic support. It's the whole gamut. So high levels of support still, as they have been since February from the US. But as we've discussed before, I'm not sure how long that lasts. It's pretty well documented that far right lawmakers wanted there to be no additional money for Ukraine in this massive bill, like zero. And in the new Congress, when Republicans have the House majority, those people are going to have more power. So last point here, it's worth pointing out that we're recording on Wednesday, December 21st, and Volodymyr Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, has left Ukraine for the first time, and his first stop, or his, as we know, as far as we know, his only stop is in Washington, D.C. He's presumably here because he also knows that he's going to have to work hard if he wants to keep the support flowing. I'm sure there's like a thank you involved in this too, but you know, he's a savvy operator, and I'm sure he knows that like this gravy train may not last forever.
Yep. Yeah. And this is on the news that part of the latest tranche of weapons and material being sent to Ukraine is the Patriot anti-aircraft missile system, which I think is the most advanced or not just anti-aircraft, but missile defense system.
Hopefully it has an effect. I was seeing an analyst say, like, I have a hard time believing that a $3 million Patriot missile is going to be used to shoot down a $20,000 Iranian drone. But, you know, maybe I hope that this works, and I hope that they can provide some respite from the bombing, that the indiscriminate bombing that Russia has been doing, so that at least in some parts of Ukraine, they can get back to normalcy.
There have been some maps going around social media that sort of show the different systems they have in Ukraine and how they might overlap and intersect and reinforce one another to provide maximum coverage. Be interesting to bring on someone who like knows about that stuff and can speak to how those different systems may work together and what the actual prospects are of real security in Ukraine.
I might know a gal or a guy.
Well, certainly more to come on Ukraine in 2023.
Unfortunately, I think you're right.
All right. So my big story for 2022 was around American democracy. We came back to this again and again, obviously in the run-up to the election, around the January 6th committee hearings, around, you know, the creeping support for authoritarianism and suspending the Constitution on the right. And coming into this year, things were looking pretty dire. I was actually looking back at an episode we did in June 2021, where we laid out the slippery slope, bad yet not unlikely case for American democracy coming into 2022. So the Democrats had a razor-thin majority in both the House and the Senate. So passing any of Biden's agenda beyond the immediate COVID relief when he first took office was pretty uncertain.
Which makes it more impressive what all he was able to accomplish, which I'm sure you're going to talk a little bit about.
For sure. And you know, from that vantage point, even if they could pass bills, it would have to be through budget reconciliation because they only have 50 senators, which means only spending measures can be a part of any major legislation you pass. So bills to protect elections and voting rights cannot pass a 50-50 Senate. Instead, you have action in the states like Georgia and Texas, making it harder for people to vote, particularly in underserved communities. That also means there's no national ban on partisan redistricting. So within state legislatures, Republicans outperformed expectations back in 2020. So you had a risk of basically a repeat of the 2010 redistricting cycle when Republicans entrenched the power they had gained as a party in highly skewed gerrymandered districts. So if all that happens and you price in an expectation of Democrats losing both of those razor-thin majorities in Congress just because of the dynamics of midterm elections, you end up with all but permanent rule by a Republican minority obsessed with grievance, conspiracy, and vendettas against perceived enemies.
When did we talk about this? June 2021?
Yeah, so 18 months ago.
Wow.
From there, a bunch of other not great stuff happened. So that was June. In August, we saw the withdrawal from Afghanistan. That was seen as a fiasco and was followed closely by the consensus realization that inflation was not transitory and was actually a longer-term challenge that was causing real pain for American consumers.
Yep.
The combination of those things has structurally moved Biden's standing with the American public, right? Prior to that August, he was, you know, 55, 60% approval ratings. Since then, he's been low 40s.
Yep.
And you had Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema in the Senate stalling the Build Back Better agenda. So Congress and more generally governance under the Democratic Party seemed stuck. Meanwhile, on the Republican side, Donald Trump seemed to be more powerful than ever within the Republican Party. So people's memories are short. January 6th was fading from public consciousness. And as we came into 2022, Trump's hand-picked crazies started winning primaries all across the country at every level. So it was looking like we may end up with a significant crop of senators, governors, and state-level secretaries of state who administer elections with a political identity centered on the big lie. But then this summer, things started to turn a little bit. So Congress got unstuck, passed the Inflation Reduction Act, the CHIPS Act. More recently in the lame duck session, the Respect for Marriage Act, the bill to avert the strike by rail workers. Likely within the next week or two, we will see the Electoral Count Reform Act become law. And then a bunch of executive action on top of that, like student loan debt forgiveness, rescheduling cannabis, pardoning people convicted of possession of marijuana. Biden opened up the Strategic Petroleum Reserve and gas prices dropped significantly starting this summer. And at the same time, the Dobbs decision in the Supreme Court exposed Republican extremism as a clear and present danger to people's lives and freedom.
Hmm.
So, you know, putting into perspective the crack you made before about, you know, the threat of transgender bathrooms and things like that. You know, I think when the Republicans were talking about this culture war bullshit and Democrats were talking about Dobbs, it became very clear who was connected to reality.
Right.
At the same time, the January 6th committee was holding these hearings that were unexpectedly effective in bringing issues around the insurrection and the health of our democracy back to the top of people's mind, helped along, of course, by Trump's inability to keep his mouth shut about any of that stuff. And And to just underscore your point from earlier, if Afghanistan made U.S. foreign policy look chaotic and isolated, Ukraine so far has shown the democratic world led by the U.S. to be united, resolute, and highly effective.
Yeah, against autocrats.
Yeah. So all of this, of course, was reflected in this year's elections, starting with the Kansas referendum, really, in favor of abortion rights over the summer, and extending through November and to this month's special election in Georgia, which cemented a gain of one seat in the Democrat Senate majority. So on a very real, of course, always, we'll get to the asterisks, but on a very real and fundamental level, no part of that worst case scenario from 18 months ago has come to pass, right? Voters in Georgia and elsewhere overcame the challenges their legislature put in place to show up and vote. The district maps were not as bad as they could have been, in part because Democrats and groups like the National Democratic Redistricting Committee got smart and worked their asses off.
And in the pod, John Bisignano, shout out.
Of course. And in part because Republicans in some places chose to protect the seats of incumbents rather than maximizing partisan gains. At this point, Trump and Trumpism look like electoral losers. It feels like the antibodies of the American democratic system are kind of doing their job.
Yeah, for now.
And yet, back to that asterisk, there are plenty of reasons to be worried. So first and foremost, with so many shitty candidates on the Republican side and so many things going right for the Democrats and their agenda through the summer and fall, this election was still really fucking close.
Yeah.
Warnock in Georgia was just a point ahead after Election Day and had to go to a runoff. Fetterman won with 51% of the vote. Mark Kelly won with 51%. Cortez Masto in Nevada won by less than a point. Katie Hobbs beat Kari Lake for Arizona governor by less than a point. Laura Kelly, the governor of Kansas, won with less than 50% of the vote. Tony Evers in Wisconsin won with 51%. So even at what looks like a low point, the version of the Republican Party that supports suspending the Constitution to make sure they stay in power is running at like 49% in a lot of places.
Yeah. And is that because they have redistricted their way into minority power, or is there actually that much support for Republicans?
Well, all those races I just listed were either Senate or governors.
So redistricting, not a factor. So, I mean, what's your analysis there? Like, why is that happening?
There's a few things I want to say about analysis and particularly around the Republican Party, but ultimately we remain a deeply divided country. The fault lines of that division still run through support for the democratic system, small d democratic system. And so we're not out of the woods. And in a very real and near-term sense, that same Republican Party will control the House of Representatives, right? They will have their own razor-thin majority, but that means Kevin McCarthy or whoever the speaker is will be extra beholden to like the Marjorie Taylor Greene wing of the party. And since the current Senate can't get a debt ceiling repeal through in the lame duck, those House Republicans will more or less have a veto over the stability of the U.S. economy.
Yeah, over everything. Because it's they'll like, basically hold that against like, oh, we don't like this provision in this bill, so we're going to like shut down the government.
Yes. Yeah, that wing within the party, that hard right wing, that Trumpy wing is still quite strong, maybe even ascendant within the Republican Party. Joe Biden used to talk about the fever breaking. And at least so far, we're not seeing signs of that. Donald Trump is the only declared Republican candidate for president in 2024. A Morning Consult poll from last week shows Trump as the clear frontrunner with 48% of the national Republican primary vote in a multi-candidate field. Number two behind him is Ron DeSantis, who, as we've discussed, is mostly just trying to put a little spit shine on Trump's id to make it slightly more palatable. In that poll, the combination of Trump and DeSantis get 81% of the Republican primary vote nationwide.
Wow.
If Trump drops out for whatever reason, such as, you know, going to jail, according to a McLaughlin poll last week, DeSantis becomes the front runner, and the combination of DeSantis and Donald Trump Jr., who, as an aside, if DeSantis is trying to polish Trump's id, Jr. is trying to distill it to its pure uncut form, like so much cocaine before a late night live stream. The combination of DeSantis and Trump Jr. in a Trump Sr. free field still get over 50% of the vote in a Republican primary nationwide. So you, then on top of that, you still have a 6-3 Supreme Court, which this term is set to hear a case about something called independent state legislature theory, which would potentially remove any checks on gerrymandered Republican state legislatures unilaterally calling the shots on how states administer elections, up to and including, you know, throwing out electors and bringing in a new slate in the next presidential election. So all to say, we're not out of the woods, but if American democracy were a Monty Python skit, it would be, I'm not dead yet.
I feel like when you look back at the June 2021 recap that you just gave, I feel like we were wrong, or at least our version of the dark world that could exist did not come to pass. And so here we are sitting at the end of 2022, and that dark world hasn't come to pass, and yet we're incapable of not painting a dark view of the future to come. It's like, this is like, if that's not quintessentially democratic, I don't know what is.
Well, I think it's not to say that we were immersed in depression, you know, 18 months ago. I think it was more of an indulgence in a fatalistic scenario that at the time was not unlikely.
And for the record, the picture you painted is also not unlikely.
Yeah. I mean, I think we don't want to be Pollyannas, right? Like we have to be clear eyed about the real threats that our country and our system face if we are going to continue being aware and supporting the fight against those forces, right? It doesn't do anyone any good to just, you know, sort of put on a happy face as the dark forces are massing.
Yeah. And it's a really good point, because in 2015 and 2016, when I was working on a political campaign, the prevailing wisdom after lots of sort of research into what worked for Obama primarily was that sort of positivity and positive messaging was what got people to the polls. Like, you're part of something bigger, you know, hope and change. Like, and I believe that that's largely true. That is not what got people to the polls in November 2022.
Yeah.
It was fear, right? And it's not this sort of fake fear or faux fear that I feel like is so much a part of the culture wars today. It was the real fear that women's rights and democracy itself could be at risk. And as we've talked about before, the places where that fear was being felt, not California, not New York, which Democrats did, you know, less good in those places than they were hoping to. The places where that fear was real and palpable was where people came out. So I think I was sort of saying that, painting the dark version of the future to, you know, rib you a little bit, but I think you're right. That like we are not out of the woods. Monty Python skit, I'm not dead, comma space yet, is appropriate. And I think that continued vigilance makes a lot of sense. I think people should continue to pay attention to what's going on.
Yeah. Continue listening to the podcast, everyone. That's the biggest conclusion here.
Yeah, don't pay attention to what's going on. Just listen to News and Brews. You'll be fine. Should we get into some spicy nuggets? Year-end spicy nuggets.
All right, let's get into some spicy nuggets.
Let's do it.
Close out the year. So not unrelated to the conversation about the soon-to-be Republican-controlled House, one of those new Republican members, George Santos from New York, it turns out in the election campaign, made up basically everything about his life story.
Stop it.
So there's this like bombshell New York Times article from Monday of this week.
I didn't see this.
Yeah. So this, you know, this New York was a big story in this election because number of House seats flipped. I think with, you know, there was a lot of back and forth, as you've heard multiple times on this podcast, around the redistricting. But this particular new member of Congress from Queens basically ran on this life story of living the American dream. you know, the son of Brazilian immigrants, a gay man who sort of rose from humble beginnings to attend a public university in New York and then go to Citigroup and Goldman Sachs and become the successful investor. And it turns out that he never went to those colleges. He never worked for those companies. The charity that he claims to have started and you know, like a dog rescue charity, there is no record of that charity existing as a nonprofit.
What?
It's wild. I highly recommend reading this.
So who is this guy?
So nobody knows. There's like some question. There's apparently an unresolved legal case for some robbery he conducted in Brazil at one point. He was evicted from his apartment about 5 years ago, despite lending himself, according to his records, like $700,000 in this campaign. So it's just weird. The story is weird and not fully explained. But both really excellent reporting by the New York Times and exceptionally poor research by his opponent in this election, who lost to this person who was just lying about everything.
Yeah, I feel like, isn't this what Oppo is for?
Yeah,
Wow. Also, where was this New York Times reporting before the election?
Fair question. But you know, it's not clear what's going to happen here. There are calls for him to resign ahead of being sworn in.
Yeah.
But the only thing really that, you know, unless Kevin McCarthy or whoever the new speaker
they're
is
not gonna do anything
with
that.
A 5-seat majority, right? Unless they're going to call for a new election in New York City, which doesn't feel likely. The only thing that would make him potentially resign would be his own sense of shame, which doesn't seem to exist.
You think that would have come out earlier in the campaign?
Yes,
if that existed. So my spicy nugget. So I, around this time of year, I get sentimental. Not gonna lie, I really like this. I like Christmas music. I like holiday. I like trees. I like all the lights. I like how cold it is. I like Christmas beer. And so I'm looking for, like, you know, something that vibes with my good feelings this time of year. And something that really just warmed the cold cockles of my heart over the past month was the success of African teams at the World Cup, and in particular Morocco. So as you'll know, Mike, I sort of did a tour of World Cup African countries earlier in the fall. I went to Senegal and Morocco and Ghana, like three of the most successful African teams, not to do anything soccer related, although, you know, maybe.
No, but you gave them the bump. That's the only explanation.
News and bruise bump. Mm-hmm. But as many people will probably know, Morocco made it to the semifinals of the World Cup, which, you know, they're the top four. Like, they were among the last four standing. And it's the first time that an African team had ever made it that far. First time a sort of Arab or Middle Eastern team had made it that far either. And it's not just a good news story. It actually means that for the next World Cup, there will be more African teams that will be able to compete as part of the World Cup. So there's real world consequences to going far in a World Cup.
Is that because the association, so the African Association will get a higher allocation?
Yeah.
The
next World Cup is going to have more teams in general.
Right.
And so the field is going to be larger. So it was going to be, I think, 8 or 9 anyways. Mm-hmm. But because they made it to the semifinal, they automatically get one more team in.
Nice.
For the whole continent. And then they have another one that basically will go to a playoff with another region. So there could be as many as 11 African teams in the next World Cup. And that's really never been even close to the case. And I got to feel like, you know, Morocco was sort of the Cinderella story. They outplayed a lot of these like juggernauts from Europe, just full stop. So I'm really looking forward to what this means for soccer in general, and just, you know, let's just celebrate the Moroccans who just really kicked ass at this World Cup.
Cheers to that.
Cheers to that. Well, Mike, happy holidays. Great to see you, my friend.
Same to you, brother.
Hopefully pleasure I'll see always. You at some point. We should do a fire pit or something like that.
Yeah, no doubt.
And all the best to Bree and the kids.
Likewise for Lauren and the kids. All right. Thanks, everyone.
See happy you New in 2023. Year.
News and Brews is hosted by Mike Heslin and Ariel Yabuke. Our producer is Alana Nevins. This episode was recorded Wednesday, December 21st, 2022 at 3:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Look out for new episodes available every 2 weeks-ish on all major podcast platforms. Thanks for listening.